I think some of you want to stay there. Thanks for coming today, and happy Labor Day. Did anybody see that storm this morning?
Yeah.
Ah, I was trying to drive to Kansas City. I got as far as Eudora. But look outside now. It just goes to show. If you don't like the weather in Kansas, wait a minute. So happy Labor Day. And I guess if you plan a picnic or a cookout, you can go right ahead. This morning, I didn't think you would. 1 year, my sister celebrated Labor Day a fairly unique way. She gave birth to my niece. Yeah, all the mothers got that, right? Labor Day on Labor Day? Yeah. We thought that was pretty clever of her. So when Sharon asked me to do this talk back in June, I decided since it was Labor Day, that would be the focus of the talk. So I looked up labor on my computer. And basically, all the different definitions and sources said the same thing. Labor is defined as hard work. So today I'm defining labor as the process that you go through in order to accomplish your magnum opus. Okay, so what's a magnum opus? Well, if it's translated directly from Latin, it means great work. Now, Wikipedia says that magnum opus can be an artist's or a composer's greatest work, but magnum opus can also just mean any great work. Now, I totally believe that each of us has a magnum opus, at least one, maybe many. You can also call it your passion for your life, your true calling, your raison d'etre. Now, here's another thing you can do on a computer. You can type in how to pronounce raison d'etre, and the little man inside will say it for you. Now, I was with my friend and partner, Vic Kentosky. Some of you know Vic. So when I tell this story, you're going to get it. When the little man in the computer said, raison d'etre, Vic said, does that mean you owe somebody a raisin? No. It means your reason for living. Now, Vic and I teach these classes, a lot of you know, called Spiritual Awakenings. They're about self-empowerment. We also do channel sessions, and I do private sessions. Two of the most frequently asked questions are, am I on my path, and how do I know what my true path is? The answer to the first question is always yes. You can't get off your path. I mean, that's why you're here. Now, you can speed right along, you can go really slow, you can come to a dead stop, you can even go backwards, but you can't get off your path. So how do I know what my true path is? Well, the flippant answer is, look at your feet. Oh, I'm on my path. But the real answer and the easiest answer for me is, what's your passion? What is it that lights your fire, rises your emotions, helps you to realize your own divine nature? That's your true calling. Now, when I was a kid, I was told that only a select few were called to be the ministers. Anybody else hear that? Actually, each of us has a true calling, a reason why. Yeah, the daughter of the minister heard that. Yeah, each of us has our own true calling, and that's our path. And I believe that once you say yes to the opportunities that guide you to your magnum opus, you can't resist. For example, I was a cabinet maker for 30-some-odd years, and I used to go to people's houses and look at their kitchens. Now, my favorites were the old houses built in the 1800s and early 1900s. And I'd look at these kitchens where things were just kind of cobbled together, and I'd call them dysfunctional kitchens. And my first response was usually, I can't do this. But I would go home, and the kitchen or the families would continue to come back to me in my prayers and meditations. And quite often, I would wake up one morning and just know how to do it. So then I'd sit down and start designing. And I would write, and Shelley can attest to this, and I would throw papers away, and I'd be writing and writing, and sometimes it would be 2-3 in the morning, and I would have forgotten about time. I never forgot to eat. You know? I always thought, because I heard other people, anyway, that never happened for me. Now, my current housemate is an artist, and a very, very good one, and he paints in my garage. And sometimes he's there at midnight, and then I get up the next morning, and he's still there at 8 o'clock. I don't know if he slept in between or not, but that's his passion. That's his calling. That's where he has to go. Now, some of you know that I love stories. And especially, I really love Bible stories. And especially, I really love Bible stories that I get to interpret the way I want. And the character in the Bible that most exemplifies for me this labor of working towards a magnum opus is Queen Esther. Now, there are only two women that got their own books of the Bible, Ruth and Esther. There are a lot of women in the Bible, but only two that got their own books. And Esther is one of them. Okay, so I'm going to tell you a little bit about Esther. Now, she was the granddaughter of one of the citizens of Judah that King Nebuchadnezzar captured Judah and made the Jews move to Babylon. Now, when she was a citizen of Persia or Babylon. Now, when she was really little, both of her parents died, and her older cousin Mordecai adopted her and raised her as his daughter. Now, according to the Bible, Mordecai sat outside the king's gate. So in my imagination, see, that's part of my interpretation here because the Bible doesn't explain it. I think Mordecai must have been a very important businessman because his establishment was located right outside the king's gate. So I think he was probably pretty prosperous, pretty prestigious. And because he was there, he heard everything that went on. He knew all the gossip, all the rumors, all the plots, everything. So when King Ahasuerus, now this is about King Ahasuerus, the descendant of Nebuchadnezzar, I can't remember how many times away. By the time Ahasuerus was the king, he ruled 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia. That's a big kingdom, even in today's standards. And one day he called his queen Vashti to him and she wouldn't come. Now, sorry honey, I have a headache. Didn't work back then. So he kicked her out. He decided she couldn't be queen anymore and he was looking for a new queen. So he called for as many virgins as wanted to come and try out for the job. Yeah, try out for the job means what you think it does. That they should, you know, they should come. Okay, so cousin Mordecai heard about this and he told Esther, I think you should try out for the job, but don't tell him you're a Jew because that might work against you. Well, Esther was young, beautiful, kind, and wise, and so she was selected and she became the queen of 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia. There was also another character in this story named Haman. Now, Haman was also a very, very smart, very industrious man. And he did his job very well. He was one of the king's ministers. Very, very talented man. Now, how many have heard of the Peter Principle, where you get promoted to your level of incompetency? Mm-hmm. Now, that basically happened for Haman. Because he kept getting promoted and promoted and promoted until he was second only to the king. He was over everybody else. And he succumbed to his fatal flaw, which was hubris. Now, hubris is the pride that goes before the fall. And boy, did he have it big time. He knew he was great. Now, we should all recognize our own greatness. The problem was, see, Haman decided he was greater than anybody else. And he wanted everybody in the kingdom to bow down to him. Now, the Jews are always getting in trouble for this. If you know anything about the Old Testament, there's a second commandment, thou shalt have no other God before me. So anytime the king said, bow down to me, there were always some Jews that said no and get in trouble, like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace and Daniel in the lion's den. And so cousin Mordecai, of course, refused to bow down. Now, I personally think there was already some bad blood between Haman and Mordecai. I think they had some history, but that's just my personal opinion. But Haman was really upset that Mordecai wouldn't bow down to him. And so he decided, well, if the Jews feel this way, I'm just going to make sure that all the Jews are killed. He did. Okay, now I think probably part of Haman's job was to make purchase orders, write checks, write edicts, you know, all the little kind of daily business that goes on, but they needed the king's signature. So I believe he wrote this edict to kill all the Jews in the month of Adar and kind of slipped it in the middle of a whole bunch of other papers that the king was supposed to sign, and then made sure he brought it to the king on a day when he was already really, really busy. Because the king signed it, and there you go. They were going to kill all the Jews in the month of Adar. Well, since cousin Mordecai sat next to the king's gate, he heard about the plot. And he went to Esther, and he said, "You got to do something to stop this. You have to save our people." And Esther said, "I can't do that. I can't go against the edict." And this happens to all of us when we're given an opportunity to do our own great work. A lot of times we say, "No, it's too big. I can't do that." But she went into prayer and meditation. She asked for guidance. She finally realized that cousin Mordecai was right. She was the only one who could do this. This is true for each of us. We're the only one that can do our own job, who can fulfill our own purpose. And guess what? You can't do it for anybody else either. Know what's on your plate and don't eat off anyone else's. So that's what she did. She accepted the assignment. Now, the first thing you do when you start this grand labor, you have to know yourself. Without any qualifications or doubts, you have to recognize the spark of divinity that is within you. No apologies, no excuses. You know that you are never alone and that guidance is available to you at all times. Now, when you're the queen of, 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia, maybe you don't have as much trouble with that as some of us might. But Queen Esther did this first. She studied Judaism. She'd never really done that before. She learned about her history. But you also have to look at your shortcomings. Look at the things that get in your way, your roadblocks. To say I am a divine creation of God and I have shortcomings, those aren't mutually exclusive. You can do that. See, Haman didn't. He didn't recognize hubris as a stumbling block. So we have to be really, really honest with ourselves, know what we can do, and know the limits of our own powers. And Esther did that as well. Then you have to know your audience. So Esther knew King Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus. She knew King Ahasuerus. She'd been queen for a long time. And she knew that she couldn't just go into him, all hot and sweaty from playing tennis or something and say, "Hey, dude, save my people." It wouldn't work. So she took her time. She prepared herself. She bathed. She put on scented oils. She fixed her hair and her makeup. She put on her finest clothes. And then she went to him in all humility, recognizing him as her king, but still with her own poise and dignity. And she waited until a time that she knew he wasn't busy so that she wouldn't interrupt anything. Now, the rule of the land was, if you went to the king and you weren't summoned, he could throw you out. He could even put you in prison. He could even have you killed. So she knew she was taking a great risk, and she wanted to do this right. So she chose the optimum time and presented herself to the king. And he was very impressed with her presence, and he touched her with his scepter, which is a way of saying, "It's all right for you to be here." And he gave her permission to speak. Now I'm going to leave them there for a minute. And I'm going to go over here to Haman for a little while. Now, one could rightly say that Haman was Esther's mortal enemy. But Esther knew a basic truth that we say in some of our classes. And that truth is this: what someone else thinks of me is none of my business. Now, the operative word there is thanks. If somebody's throwing rocks at you, then it's your business and you need to do something. Duck or get out of the way or something. But when someone thinks of you, it's none of your business. So Esther did not try to argue with Haman. She didn't try to change his mind. She didn't try to get all her friends together to form an army to convince him that he was wrong. She didn't talk to the king and say, make him stop that. Make him stop being mean to me. Now Jesus, a few hundred years later, said, be kind to your enemies. Do good to those who persecute you. And Esther already knew this. So when the king said, tell me what you want, she said, I want to prepare a banquet in your honor and in Haman's honor. In other words, she invited her mortal enemy to dinner, and not just fried chicken and okra. A banquet. And back in those days, a banquet was something else. It was the finest foods from India to Ethiopia, prepared by the finest chefs in the land. There was entertainment, dancers, poets, musicians. It was quite a deal. And it would be an honor of the king and of Haman. Now, when you put your whole attention to the accomplishment of your magnum opus, you create an energy field where things simply fall in place, and we call that synchronicity. Unfortunately, too many of us don't do that. We waste our emotional capital. We allow ourselves to get bogged down with things that don't really matter, like, did you hear what he said to her? What do you mean I can't do it the way I want to? And somebody's telling tales on my granddaughter, and we get, you know, scattered. Instead of focusing on what's really important, I try to remember to ask myself, will this matter in a year? And if it doesn't, I try to go to something that does matter. And Queen Esther was so good at this. She was completely focused on her goal. So that night, after she invited the king and Haman to the banquet, the king couldn't sleep because he started thinking, you know, maybe I haven't honored people that have served me well. And so he started looking through his journal, and he found a journal entry from about 3 years ago where cousin Mordecai, who sat right outside his gate, had uncovered a plot. Two of the servants had planned to assassinate the king, and cousin Mordecai had discovered this and put a stop to it, saving the king's life. And the king thought, man, I didn't even properly thank him. Now, at the same time that night, Haman, who could have made a different decision anywhere along the line, I mean, he could have gotten caught up in this energy of goodwill. Instead, his heart became harder, and he was more involved with his own hubris. He had left the palace that day so proud of himself to be honored by the queen. And there was Mordecai standing straight, tall, still not bowing before him. And he went home and told his wife and his cronies about being, you know, chosen as the guest of honor at this banquet. And then he said, and that Mordecai, you know, I can't stand him. I'm not going to wait till the month of Adar. I'm going to go into the king tomorrow, and I'm going to slip in an edict that I can execute him right now. So the next morning, Haman rushed into the king's office, and the king was there. And he said, before Haman could talk, the king said, I need your help. If I want to honor someone who has served me really well, how should I do it? Well, Haman couldn't think of anybody who had served the king better than he had. So he thought, well, guess what? King's gonna honor me. So I'm going to read to you what he said, because his words are a lot better than mine. Okay, let me find this book a minute. And by the way, I use the Bible, it's easy to read from. So Haman said to the king, for the man whom the king wishes to honor, let royal robes be brought which the king has worn, and a horse that the king has ridden with a royal crown on its head. Let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials. Let him robe the man whom the king wishes to honor, and let him conduct the man on horseback through the open square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done for the man whom the king wishes to honor. And the king said, wow, You know how to throw a good party. And I'm going to let you be the noble official, and you get to put my robe on Mordecai and let him ride my horse and lead him through the city. Haman was beside himself, but he had to do it because the king said. So when time came for the banquet, it was spectacular. The king had the time of his life. Haman, not really so much. And at the end, when they were enjoying their after-dinner drinks, I'm going to read again. The king turned to Esther and said, "What is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. Even to the half of my kingdom, it shall be fulfilled." Then Queen Esther answered, "If I have won your favor, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me. That is my petition, and the lives of my people, that is my request." And then for the first time, she revealed herself as a Jew. And the king said, "Well, who has done this thing?" Because he didn't know anything about it. He hadn't read the edict. And Esther said, "Well, it was Haman." And so then I imagine that the king went through all the papers and found the edict. And he called Haman before him. He said, "You have dishonored the office I gave you. You have dishonored me and my kingdom." Now, Haman could have apologized, even at that point. He could have resigned. He could have asked for a job at a lower office. He could have said, I'm sorry, I want to learn, I want to do better. But he didn't. He was still stuck in hubris. He was still sure that he was right and everybody else was wrong. The Jews should die. He couldn't let go. He couldn't repent. And so the king took away his titles and all his possessions and his lands and all his riches, all of which he'd earned by serving the king. And see if you can guess who he gave it to. Anybody? Yeah. He gave it to cousin Mordecai. And the Jews were saved. So Queen Esther fulfilled her magnum opus, as we all can. And the blessings that came from that were greater than even she had imagined. So King Ahasuerus, cousin Mordecai, Queen Esther, all the Jews of the land, and presumably everyone here lived happily ever after. Thank you. Namaste.